From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It's still up to us to make what we can of it. It's not out of our control. I still believe in love, peace. I still believe in positive thinking when I can do it.
It was 25 years ago today. John Lennon murdered outside his New York apartment. We'll talk with historian John Wiener about Lennon's life, why the FBI followed him, and why Richard Nixon wanted him deported and silenced.
So today, we miss his spirit, we miss his adventurousness, we miss his music, and, you know, it's a sad day.
And we play part two of our conversation with British journalist Stephen Gray on how he tracks so-called torture flights when the CIA kidnaps a suspect off the street and transports him to a secret prison. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, kidnappers have extended their threat to execute four Western aid workers by another 48 hours till Saturday. The Swords of Righteousness Brigade has threatened to kill the four members of the Christian Peacemaker team unless all prisoners are freed from U.S. and Iraqi-run detention centers. On Wednesday, the captors released a new video of the hostages. The video appears to show hostages Norman Kember of London and Tom Fox of Virginia. Canadian hostages James Loney and Harmeet Singh Sudan were not shown. The aid workers' capture has sparked an international outpour of calls for their release. On Wednesday, a Jordanian cleric jailed in Britain for alleged links to al-Qaeda called on the kidnappers to release the four men. In a tape video, Abu Qatada said the aid workers should not be punished for the actions of their governments. Elsewhere in Iraq, a suicide bombing on a bus headed for the Shiite city of Nasiriya has killed up to 30 people, nearly 40 others injured in the attack. Meanwhile, in Baghdad, at least one U.S. soldier was killed in a series of explosions that hit the city earlier this morning. In Miami, Rigoberto Alpizar, a passenger reportedly suffering from a mental disorder, was killed by federal air marshals Wednesday. Witnesses say Alpizar ran off the plane after claiming he had a bomb in his backpack shortly before it was set to take off. His wife followed behind him, yelling out to bystanders her husband had not taken medication for a serious bipolar condition. Air marshals shot Alpizar five times when he refused to lie on the ground. No bombs were found in the backpack or in any of the plane's luggage. Alpiz and his wife were reportedly traveling back from a missionary trip in Peru. The shooting marked the first time federal air marshals since they were introduced aboard airplanes following the September 11th attacks. British playwright Harold Pinter accepted a Nobel Prize Wednesday by delivering a stinging criticism of U.S. and British foreign policy. Pinter won the award for literature, the world's highest honor for a writer, in October. At a ceremony in Sweden Wednesday, Pinter accepted the award via a tape video message from Britain, where he's being treated for cancer. These are edited excerpts from his speech.
Crimes of the United States have been systematic, constant, vicious, remorseless, but very few people have actually talked about them. The invasion of Iraq was a bandit act, an act of blatant state terrorism, demonstrating absolute contempt for the concept of international law. The invasion was an arbitrary military action inspired by a series of lies upon lies and gross manipulation of the media and therefore of the public. I believe that despite the enormous odds which exist, unflinching, unswerving, fierce intellectual determination as citizens to define the real truth of our lives and our societies is a crucial obligation which devolves upon us all. It is, in fact, mandatory. If such a determination is not embodied in our political vision, we have no hope of restoring what is so nearly lost to us, the dignity of man.
Nobel Prize winning playwright Harold Pinter, author of the plays The Caretaker and The Homecoming, among much more. In a ruling his defense team is calling a major victory, Mumia Abu-Jamal has won the right to appeal his murder conviction on three separate grounds. He was convicted for the murder of a police officer. Mumia Abu-Jamal will be able to appeal on grounds of both judge and jury bias. He'll also appeal on the basis the trial prosecutor misled jurors. In a news release, Mumia's attorney, Robert Bryan, wrote the court's rulings are, quote, of enormous constitutional significance and go to the very essence of Mumia's right to a fair trial. Today, we achieved a great victory in the campaign to win a new trial and the eventual freedom of Mumia. Close quotes. Opening briefs in the appeal will be heard on January 17th. In the third disaster to befall China's mining communities in recent weeks, an explosion in a northern coal mine killed over 60 workers Wednesday. An additional 13 were missing. 2 weeks ago, an explosion at another northern mine killed over 170 people. Over 6,000 miners died in China last year, making it the world's deadliest country for mine shafts. In Egypt, police killed 8 people in clashes with angry voters on the last day of the country's parliamentary elections. The dead included a 14-year-old boy. Another 2 people have been killed, hundreds have been injured, and over 1,000 arrested since voting opened over a month ago. Government forces have reportedly blocked in areas known to be hostile to President Hosni Mubarak's ruling National Democratic Party. Early results show independent candidates affiliated with banned party the Muslim Brotherhood won over 80 seats at the end of the third round. In Iraq, Saddam Hussein's trial reconvened Wednesday without the jailed former president. On Tuesday, Saddam Hussein had vowed he would not return to the trial, citing alleged mistreatment. At one point, he yelled at the trial judge, quote, "I will not come to an unjust court. Go to hell." Saddam Hussein is currently facing charges over a massacre in a Shiite village in 1982, the first of several war crimes allegations brought against him. The trial was adjourned until December 21st. A group representing Inuit peoples in the northern Arctic region has filed a landmark human rights complaint against the United States before the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. The Inuit Circumpolar Conference says the U.S. role as the world's number one carbon polluter is helping to foster global warming that's destroying their habitat. A spokesperson for the group said, quote, "For Inuit, warming is likely to disrupt or even destroy their hunting and food-sharing culture as reduced sea ice causes the animals on which they depend to decline, become less accessible, and possibly become extinct." The complaint comes as over 100 countries continue to meet in Montreal at the United Nations Climate Change Conference. The U.S. is leading calls to block a global accord on mandatory emissions standards. The UN's top human rights official says the U.S.-led so-called war on terrorism is undermining international safeguards against torture. Louise Arbour, the High Commissioner for Human Rights at the UN, made the remarks in a statement marking Human Rights Day. Arbour wrote, quote, "The absolute ban on torture, a cornerstone of the international human rights edifice, is under attack. The principle once believed to be unassailable, the inherent right to physical integrity and dignity of person, is becoming a casualty of the so-called war on terrorism." U.S. Ambassador to the UN John Bolton criticized Arbour's remarks, saying, quote, "I think it's inappropriate and illegitimate for an international civil servant to second-guess the conduct that we're engaged in the war on terror, with nothing more as evidence than what she reads in the newspapers," Bolton said. Meanwhile, sources told The Washington Post the Bush administration is backing down on efforts to push for a Senate measure that would exempt the CIA from a ban on torturing detainees. Israel's launched a series of strikes on the Gaza Strip in what it calls a retaliation for a suicide bombing that killed 5 Israelis in Netanya Monday. Islamic Jihad, which carried out the bombing, had called that attack a response to Israeli assaults on its members. On Wednesday, an Israeli warplane killed Mahmoud al-Arkan, a top member of the local popular resistance committees. 10 other people were wounded in the attack, including 3 children struck by shrapnel. In New Jersey, Governor-elect John Corzine has named Democratic Congressmember Robert Menendez to fill out the remaining year of Corzine's Senate term. Menendez would be the first minority member to represent New Jersey in the Senate and would be the third sitting Latino senator. And today marks the 25th anniversary of the assassination of John Lennon. On December 8, 1980, Lennon was gunned down by a deranged fan, Mark David Chapman, outside his home here in New York City. He was 40 years old. The day of worldwide remembrances include a concert in Cuba, an exhibition in Paris, a memorial service in Lennon's hometown of Liverpool. A confrontation is brewing over memorial plans in the Strawberry Fields area of Central Park outside the Manhattan apartment building where Lennon was shot. Police say they'll prevent Lennon fans from hoping a planned overnight vigil. We'll have more on John Lennon after this.
As soon as you're born, they make you feel small by giving you no time instead of it all. Till the pain is so big you feel nothing at all. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. They hurt you at home and they hit you at school. They hate you if you're clever and they despise a fool. Till you're so fucking crazy you can't follow their rules. A working class hero is something to be. A working class hero is something to be. When the tortured and scared.
Working class hero, John Lennon. 25 years ago today, Howard Cosell broke into Monday Night Football with an announcement that shocked the country.
Yes, we have to say it. Remember, this is just a football game. No matter who wins or loses, an unspeakable tragedy confirmed to us by ABC News in New York City. John Lennon, outside of his apartment building on the west side of New York City, the most famous perhaps of all of the Beatles, shot twice in the back, rushed to Roosevelt Hospital, dead on arrival.
John Lennon, dead at the age of 40. As soon as word of his murder was announced, hundreds of fans began gathering in Central Park near the Dakota apartment building where Lennon lived and was shot. A day after he died, his wife, Yoko Ono, said, "John loved and prayed for the human race. Please do the same for him." Millions mourned his death around the world. As a leader of the Beatles, John Lennon helped to transform popular music. But to his fans, he was far more than just a musician. While the highlights of Lennon's career with the Beatles are well known, Lennon is less remembered for his political activism and dedication to peace. Lennon wrote some of the most famous songs of the anti-war movement: Give Peace a Chance, Imagine, and Happy Christmas, War is Over. He sang at political protests against the Vietnam War in support of the radical John Sinclair, and even for the prisoners of Attica. He and Yoko made international headlines simply by lying in bed as part of their bed-in for peace. The U.S. government saw Lennon as such a serious threat that President Nixon attempted to have him deported in 1972. In addition, the FBI closely monitored his actions and amassed a file on Lennon of over 300 pages. Today, on the 25th anniversary of John Lennon's death, we speak with historian John Wiener about Lennon's politics and his FBI files. John Wiener is a history professor at the University of California, Irvine, and the author of two books on Lennon, Give Me Some Truth, the John Lennon FBI Files, and Come Together, John Lennon and His Times. I talked to John Wiener and asked him for his thoughts on this 25th anniversary of Lennon's death.
Well, you know, there's going to be a lot of media coverage about the lovable lad from Liverpool and about Beatlemania, but I think it's important to remember that Lennon put a lot of work into fighting the war in Vietnam. He was an activist in the peace movement, and he paid a very heavy price for that. In 1972, Richard Nixon tried to deport him because of his peace movement activity. I think That is a legacy that's worth remembering today, more than Beatlemania and more than I Want to Hold Your Hand.
You wrote a book about the FBI files and John Lennon called Give Me Some Truth. Can you talk about why you started on this quest to get the full FBI files of John Lennon and how much you have learned? What was happening to him when he left Britain and came to this country under the presidency of Richard Nixon?
Well, Lennon arrived in the United States in 1970, 1971, moved to New York. He wanted to be part of what was going on. What was going on in New York was the anti-war movement, and he became friends with Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and Bobby Seale and other activists, and he wanted to join in, basically, with the movement, which is pretty unusual for a superstar. Lots of superstars have causes, but he wanted to help end the war in Vietnam, and he tried various different strategies of doing that in different ways at different times. That's what got him in trouble with the Nixon administration. I filed a Freedom of Information request a really long time ago in 1981, just after he was killed, just to see if the FBI had any documents on him. I thought they must, since they tried to deport him in 72. At that time, they told us they had around 300 pages, but they weren't going to release most of them because of their national security status. I was lucky enough to get the help of the ACLU of Southern California in taking this case to court. We filed a lawsuit under the Freedom of Information Act in 1983. In 1997, that's what, 15 years later, virtually all the issues were resolved by the Clinton administration. They released almost all the pages we were seeking. They paid $204,000 of our legal expenses, but they still withheld 10 pages, which they said were national security documents provided by a foreign government under a promise of confidentiality. We're still trying to get those 10 pages, and just recently, a court ordered the FBI to release them, and the FBI has now told us they are going to appeal that decision. So 10 pages to go, national security documents.
So you're saying, Professor Weiner, that John Lennon is still a threat to the national security of this country?
Well, I'm not saying that, but the FBI is telling us that they can't release these 10 pages because they contain information provided by a foreign government under a promise of confidentiality. Now, we're not even allowed to know the name of the foreign government. My guess is that it's not Afghanistan. And in fact, there's a guy in England named David Shaler, a former employee of MI5, the British organization that corresponds to our FBI. He says he saw a Lennon file at MI5. He described its contents. It had information about Lennon's ties with the British New Left and the anti-war movement in London and the Irish movement. Shaler was prosecuted by the Brits under their Official Secrets Act and sentenced to 6 months in prison for revealing this information. Our assumption is that's the information that the government of the United States is withholding today. It's provided by the foreign government of Britain. It concerns Lennon's political activities in London in 1969 and 1970. We don't see any reason why information about the political activities 35 years ago of a dead rock star need to remain classified today. But the FBI is willing to go to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and try to convince a three-judge panel that this material can't be released.
John Weiner, can you talk about what John Lennon hoped to do in this country, joining up with the anti-war movement, registering voters, and how he was thwarted, specifically how he was dealing with the Nixon administration?
Yeah, Lennon tried to figure out ways that he could use his power as a celebrity to help end the war. And the idea that he developed, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and other people, was that he should headline a national concert tour in 1972 that would coincide with the presidential election campaign. 72, Nixon was still president and preparing to run for re-election. The war in Vietnam had reached a peak. It was clear that this was going to be a big issue in 72. The concert tour that Lennon was planning would have been quite a big deal just because no Beatle had toured the United States since the lads waved farewell at Candlestick Park in 1966. But what Lennon had in mind was something different. He wanted to combine rock music with radical politics and use the tour to urge young people to register to vote. 1972 was the first year that 18-year-olds were given the right to vote, so that was going to be an important project, and vote against the war, and that meant voting against Nixon. And Nixon got wind of this plan and promptly began deportation proceedings against Lennon to try to get him out of the country to prevent this tour from ever happening. They were able to do one concert. It was in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1970, December 71, where they tried out this idea. It was the Free John Sinclair concert. John Sinclair was a local movement activist and leader who had been sentenced to 10 years in the Michigan State Prison for possession of two joints of marijuana. It was a big national issue in 1971, and Lennon headlined a fantastic show that involved political activist Jerry Rubin spoke, Bobby Seale spoke, Stevie Wonder showed up to play. And we have tape of Lennon's appearance that night. It's in Ann Arbor at Chrysler Arena, December 1971, 15,000 people in the audience.
Let's go to John Lennon that night.
We came here not only to help John and to spotlight what's going on, but also to show and to say to all of you that apathy isn't it, and that we can do something. Okay, so flower power didn't work, so what? We start again. This song I wrote for John Sinclair. Easy now. Sneaky. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4. It ain't fair, John Sinclair, in the step of breathing air. Won't you care for John Sinclair, in the step of breathing air? Let him be, set him free. Let him set him if he was a soldier man shooting gooks in Vietnam, if he was the CIA selling dope and making hay, he'd be free. They'd let him be breathing air like you and me.
Back in a minute.
They gave him 10 for 2. What else can Judge Columbus do? We got to, 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 got to set him free.
That was John Lennon singing at a Free John Sinclair rally in Ann Arbor, Michigan in 1971. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guest is historian John Wiener, the author of two books on John Lennon, including Gimme Some Truth, the John Lennon FBI Files. I asked John Wiener what happened to John Lennon after he performed at the Free John Sinclair rally.
The first thing that happened was that John Sinclair got out of prison 2 days later on appeal. It was quite an amazing victory that nobody had really expected. When I got the John Lennon FBI file, the first stuff in there is a report from an undercover agent who was one of the 15,000 people at Chrysler Arena that night. He wrote down every word John Lennon said, including all the words to the song, including gotta set him free, sent those to J. Edgar Hoover. They were promptly classified as confidential and kept secret for the next 12 years. But this formed this got the Nixon administration concerned that there really might be some potential here to affect the election. Now, in retrospect, it seems very unlikely, since Nixon won by an overwhelming landslide in 1972. Only Massachusetts voted for George McGovern. You remember the slogan, "Don't blame me, I'm from Massachusetts." But, you know, back in December 1971, no one was sure what was going to happen in the election. No one was sure who the Democratic candidate was going to be. No one was sure how significant the youth vote was going to be. And it was, Nixon did a lot of things that I didn't like, but he was also an astute judge of American politics. And I think if Nixon was concerned that Lennon's political plan to register young voters might play a role in the 72 election, I'm willing to accept Nixon's judgment that there might have been something to that.
The issue that Nixon held over John Lennon of deporting him over drug charges, even those drug charges, questionable, is that right? They were brought when he was in Britain?
Well, the Nixon administration's claim for deporting Lennon was that it was just a routine administration of the then existing immigration law, which held that you could not be admitted to the country if you had any conviction for drugs, no matter how insignificant, no matter what the circumstances. And Lennon had pled guilty to a misdemeanor charge of cannabis possession in London a couple of years earlier. So the Nixon administration said he'd just been admitted improperly, and therefore he had to leave. Lennon claimed that this was motivated by a desire to silence him as a spokesman for the peace movement, and I think the FBI files show Lennon was right about that. Everything in the file is about Lennon's political activism, the people he was hanging around with, the plans he was making, and virtually none of it is about his status as immigration visa.
Another major political event he was involved with was in 1971, the Attica Uprising upstate New York, the prisoners who were protesting prison conditions. Can you talk about what John Lennon had to do with that?
Yeah, in September 1971, there was an uprising at Attica Prison in upstate New York of something like a couple of thousand, mostly black inmates. Seized the prison, had a whole list of demands, most of which were completely reasonable. Decent health care, religious freedom for Muslims, alternatives to pork in the diet, uncensored reading materials. The prison administration agreed to virtually all the demands, but then one horrible morning, 1,400 New York State troopers stormed the prison. They killed They killed 32 prisoners and 10 guards and injured something like 80 more. This was, you know, a complete outrage. And the next month, December 1971, there was a protest meeting and a benefit concert for the families of the prisoners who'd been killed in the uprising. That was held at the Apollo Theater in Harlem. And John Lennon went because this you know, disturbed him. He hated what had happened at Attica. We have tape, very unusual, rare tape of Lennon speaking on stage live at the Apollo, 1,500 people who'd gathered to protest the murders at Attica Prison.
John Lennon in Harlem.
I'd just like to say It's an honor and a pleasure to be here at the Apollo, and for the reasons we're all here. Some of you might wonder what I'm doing here with no drummers and no nothing like that. Well, you might know I lost my old band, or I left it. I'm putting an electric band together, but it's not ready yet, and these things like this keep coming up, so I have to just busk it. So I'm going to sing a song now you might know. It's called Imagine. Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try. No hell below us. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people.
John Lennon at the Apollo in Harlem after the Attica uprising. Of course, then New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller right after the prisoners rose up. It was another September 11th, 1971. September 9th, it began. On the 13th, he called out the New York State troopers, and they opened fire, killing 39 men, including guards, critically wounding more than 80 others and injuring hundreds. John Wiener.
Yeah, it was a terrible day, and it's interesting that Lennon, wanted to be part of that protest, too. So, New York was very important to him, and he wanted to be part of the political life of New York and part of the movement in New York. And that's one of the reasons why it was particularly horrible that he got killed in New York, which was the city that he thought of as kind of the center of the world, the home of the free.
Speaking of freedom, there is a very famous image that will be no doubt played throughout today, and that was the bed-in, John Lennon and yes. Yoko Ono in Canada. Can you talk about this?
1968. Well, the first bed-in was in Amsterdam. John and Yoko got married in 1968. A lot of things happened in 1968, and one of them was John and Yoko got married at Gibraltar near Spain, as they said in the song, The Ballad of John and Yoko. But even as early as 1968, they were thinking about the war and what they could do to join the anti-war movement, and they decided to declare that their honeymoon would be a week-long protest against the war in Vietnam. But instead of marching outside the American embassy at Trafalgar Square in London, they decided to declare that they would stay in bed to protest the war. This outraged the mainstream media and a lot of the left, too. We have tape of Lennon explaining the logic behind the bed-in.
What we're really doing is sending out a message to the world, but mainly to the youth, especially the youth or anybody really that's interested in protesting for peace or protesting against any forms of violence. And the things like the Grosvenor Square marches in London, the end product of it was just newspaper stories about riots and fighting. And we did the bed event in Amsterdam and the bag piece in Vienna just to give people an idea that there's many ways of protest, and this is one of them, and anybody could grow their hair for peace, or give up a week of their holiday for peace, or sit in a bag for peace. Protest against peace anyway, but peacefully, because we think that peace is only got by peaceful methods, and that to fight the establishment with their own weapons is no good, because they always win, and they've been winning for thousands of years. They know how to play the game violence. And it's easier for them when they can recognize you and shoot you.
So this was in Amsterdam. Is that right, John?
He's referring to Amsterdam as in the past there. He's saying we did this in Amsterdam. He's explaining why they did the bed-in in Amsterdam. Here they're, adopting a pacifist position, and they're criticizing what they regarded as kind of the stereotyped forms of protest the protest march, the protest speech, and they wanted a movement that was more innovative and more imaginative in its tactics. As I said, this outraged a lot of people on the left as well as a lot of people in the mainstream, but I think it did accomplish their main goal. They got worldwide publicity as opponents of the war in Vietnam.
Imagine is a song that has tremendous power through the decades, through the ages. After 9/11, it was reported that Clear Channel had it on a list of songs that would not be allowed to be played on their stations, and that was significant because Clear Channel owns more than 1,200 radio stations in this country.
Yeah, well, he does say, imagine no more countries. It isn't hard to do. And he also says, imagine no religion. It's easy if you try. Of course, the Christian right in the United States finds that a completely outrageous statement, and they've been campaigning against that song ever since he recorded it in 1970.
And then, John Wiener, there's Give Peace a Chance. Talk about the story behind that.
Well, you know, Lennon wanted to... Basically, Lennon is a musician, a songwriter, a performer, and he wanted to write a song for the movement, and he did. It was Give Peace a Chance. It did become the anthem of the anti-war movement. 500,000 people sang Give Peace a Chance in the demonstration at the Washington Monument in the fall of 1969. Do we have time to listen to my interview with Pete Seeger talking about what it was like that day?
Well, in November 1969, I guess I faced the biggest audience I'd ever faced in my entire life. Hundreds of thousands. How many I know, I don't know, but it stretched as far as the eye could see up the hillside and over the hill past the Washington Monument. And Brother Kirkpatrick and I were singing together and tried to get them singing with us, but the crowd was too big to get the rhythm. After two songs, I looked over to the chairperson of the day, said, okay, if we try one more, and she nodded her head. And I said to Kirk, follow me on this. He'd only heard me it once before, but I had in the back of my mind I might have to try it. I'd only heard the song myself a few days before, and I confess when I first heard it, I didn't think much of it. I thought, well, that's kind of a nothing of a song. It doesn't go anyplace, does it? I heard a young woman sing it at a peace rally. All we are saying is give peace a chance. She gave it a kind of an oom-pa-pa, oom-pa-pa waltz, like a German band. I don't know if John Lennon's record had that or not. I never heard his record. Matter of fact, I've hardly ever heard any of his records. I admired the guy, the little I heard. I'd never heard this song except as the young woman sang it to me a few days earlier.
And did you have the impression that everybody who was there already knew it?
I didn't know if they had ever heard it before. But I decided to try singing it over and over again until they did know it. Well, Kirk and I started singing this, and after about a minute or so, I realized that it was still growing. Sure enough, Peter, Paul, and Mary jumped up to our left and started joining in on another microphone and giving us a little more instrumental and harmony background. A couple more minutes, Mitch Miller hops up on the stage to our right and starts waving his arms. And I realized it was getting better and better as more and more people were able to latch onto it because it was so slow. And then they started swaying their bodies in time, and banners and flags would sway to the left and the right in a big, slow ballet. If you can imagine, several hundred thousands of people moving their bodies. Parents had their small children on their shoulders, and it was a tremendously moving thing to realize his song was finally getting through, where not a single other song of the day had really gotten people to join in on it.
Pete, what do you think about the politics of Give Peace a Chance?
Well, undoubtedly, some people wanted to say a lot more than that. On the other hand, History gets made when people come to the same conclusion from many different directions. And this song did hit a common denominator. There's no doubt about it.
John Lennon singing Give Peace a Chance. John Wiener, can you talk about John Lennon in the Beatles and their political views and how the U.S., how the Nixon administration dealt with them overall?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the Beatles, there was a tension within the Beatles that we only found out about later, where Paul McCartney basically was an entertainer who wanted to sing songs that would delight and thrill people. John Lennon and also George Harrison were much more interested in the world and what was going on and how they could be part of what was going on. I mean, it was an exciting time to be young. So the Beatles struggled with this internal debate they were having. In 1966, when they came to the United States, at their first press conference, they said, we hate war. War is wrong. We think about it every day. They'd been advised not to do this by their management. This was something, taking a political stand like that in the United States at the time was something only for folkies like Joan Baez or Bob Dylan or something like that. Rock groups never said they were against the war in Vietnam, especially in 1964. I think probably most Americans hadn't even heard of the war in Vietnam. And for the Beatles to say, we think about it every day, was a truly remarkable thing. I don't think most people noticed it at the time. But obviously, they were already wrestling with the issue of what they could do, and especially Lennon, and to a lesser extent, Harrison also. If you look at Lennon's songs, a lot of them are about what's going on around him. You know, they were spokesmen for the counterculture. They were spokesmen for psychedelic drugs. And they were spokesmen for youth rebellion against authority in general. You know, the most important thing was that their songs were so great. I think that's, if the songs weren't so great, we wouldn't be talking about them today. But there was more to the songs. There was an interest in engaging with the political spirit of the times that we don't see very often in the history of pop music.
John Wiener, can you talk about Abbie Hoffman?
Well, Abbie Hoffman was one of the people that that John and Yoko sought out when they arrived in New York in 1970 and 71. He was one of the people who developed this plan for a national concert tour where they would try to register young people to vote against the war and vote against Nixon. After Lennon was shot and killed, I interviewed Abbie Hoffman, and I asked them what it was like working with John and Yoko at that time.
John and Yoko did come and look up myself and Jerry Rubin, and they wanted it known around the New York scene that they had a political side to them. Before they even got here, they had a lot more political consciousness than just, say, the bed-ins or other things that they were kind of involved in that might appear a little flaky. Must have met at least a dozen times then, and we started to organize demonstrations at the Republican convention, which at that time was still in San Diego. And it was, of course, all these conversations were monitored by the FBI and God knows who else, you know. It was these conversations that, number one, forced the convention to move to Miami, and number two, got the Immigration Service on John Lennon's back. And, you know, I think it's wise to remember that for 6 years he was hounded, not just because of some pot possession charge. I mean, there's probably 100, 200 people a week that walk and come into this country with much more. Many more charges, but because that he was political and was forming alliances with radicals. Yeah, he talked sheer poetry. I mean, you totally hung on every word, and he was extremely dramatic and ran the gambit from, manic excitation, to sad, depressive, moody states. And he just pulled off one night and just went over a corner and, 3 minutes, wrote a song, came back and sang it. It was quite a thing to witness.
That was Abbie Hoffman. Of course, Abbie Hoffman later himself committed suicide. John Wiener, this is the 25th anniversary of the death of the murder of John Lennon. Any thoughts on that, on his murder?
Well, the first thing we think of is who gets assassinated in America? It's Martin Luther King and it's John Lennon. It's a scary thing about America. For people who grew up in the 60s, that day, December 8, 1980, was one of the very worst days because, the dream really was over at that point. Lennon was a guy who you never knew what he was going to do. He was willing to embarrass himself. He tried out things that often didn't work, but he was always interesting. And, we had the feeling that sort of he was part of us. And so today we miss his spirit. We miss his adventurousness. We miss his music, and, it's a sad day.
John Wiener, author of Give Me Some Truth, The John Lennon Files. You can visit his website at LennonFBIFiles.com or go to our website at democracynow.org. We'll link to all. In 1981, John Wiener produced a two-hour documentary for Pacifica Radio called John Lennon, The Political and the Personal. Special thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives. We'll be back in a minute.
There are places I remember all my life, though some have changed, some forever, not for better. Some have gone and some remain. All these places have their moments. With lovers and friends, I still can recall.
The Beatles in My Life, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 400 radio and TV stations around the country. On Pacifica and NPR, Low Power FM, college and community stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. We're also video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Seeking to diffuse growing controversy over torture and the U.S. treatment of detainees, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said on Wednesday, U.S. interrogators are forbidden to use torture both at home and abroad.
As a matter of U.S. policy, The United States obligations under the CAT, which prohibits, of course, cruel and inhumane and degrading treatment. Those obligations extend to U.S. personnel wherever they are, whether they are in the United States or outside of the United States.
Rice's comments came on a stop in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev. She's faced repeated questions on her European trip over the U.S. treatment of detainees and reports the CIA is running a network of secret prisons in Europe. Officials in Washington and Europe praised Rice's comments, saying they signaled a major White House policy shift. Previous public statements by the Bush administration have asserted the torture ban did not apply abroad. But human rights groups say any concession is cosmetic. Rice's remarks don't clarify questions about what definitions the U.S. applies to terms like torture and cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. Her comments also did not directly address the practice of extraordinary rendition, where CIA agents essentially kidnap people, transporting them to overseas prisons for interrogation by foreign governments. We go now to journalist Stephen Gray, who's written extensively on these secret CIA programs for the Sunday Times of London, New Statesman, New York Times, and other publications. Over a year and a half ago, he was one of the first to expose that the CIA was flying detainees to secret prisons around the world. He joined us yesterday in our Firehouse studio, and I asked him how he first got on the trail of the so-called torture flights.
Well, it all began really when Guantanamo was opened up, and I heard from my sources that there was something else going on, that Guantanamo, if you like, was only the public face of the US detainee policy, and that there were thousands of other people held elsewhere. And it was a matter of how do you actually investigate something so secret going on around the world. And it proved to be the planes that kind of unlocked the story, because it gave us a way of verifying the accounts of people who'd been released, who made some pretty extreme claims, such as this German citizen, Khaled al-Masri, you know, describing how he was abandoned in the mountains of Albania by the CIA. When he told that to his family, they said, you know, don't bother telling your friends on this, because no one will believe you. It was only really by finding out about these planes and seeing all the movements that corroborated the accounts of these detainees that all this became credible, and we actually saw the tentacles, if you like, of this whole network of jails and prisons which the U.S. Appears to have supervised.
What are the companies involved in these secret flights? What does the U.S. military or CIA, what companies are they using?
Well, it seems they've, as they did in the Vietnam era with the Air America, they have a new generation of front companies that have been set up to run what appear to be civilian flights, but are in fact flights chartered by the U.S. government, and actually planes which are owned by the U.S. government. And these travel around the world in the guise of normal civilian planes, but in fact are CIA planes.
Do you know some of the names of these companies?
No, absolutely, and we have published those, yeah.
Like?
Well, I'm not going to name all the companies on air, because that would maybe open me up to some legal action. So I think that the New York Times, for example, has published the full list of those companies.
And of course, Khaled al-Masri, the ACLU has filed a suit not only against the CIA, but against the actual individual companies of planes.
That's right, yeah.
You, in May 2004, wrote a piece called America's Gulag. Interesting, because when the Amnesty International used that term, they were slammed by the highest levels of the Bush administration, right up through President Bush. America's Gulag, uncovering a secret global network of prisons and planes that allows the U.S. to hand over its enemies for interrogation and sometimes torture by the agents of its more unsavory allies. How do these prisons, how does the CIA connect with them, find them? Now, most recently, Condoleezza Rice was in Romania. The allegations that the secret prisons are in, among other places, Romania and Poland.
What?
How do they work with the governments? Germany as well. I mean, here was an anti-war country, but the U.S. is working with Germany.
Yeah. Well, the phrase gulag, I think, is relevant not because of the numbers involved. I mean, clearly there were tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of prisoners in the Soviet gulag. But what's the interesting parallel is to look at how Solzhenitsyn described the Soviet gulag, which was a chain of islands of secret detention centers that existed hidden beneath a normal society, so that, you know, behind a wall that appeared normal would be these prisons hidden behind. And what you have here are these these flights moving around through very normal airports, but inside are prisoners in the war on terror. And likewise, these jails are scattered around the world, and no one sees them. They're connected by these flights, and the numbers are probably a few dozen in the CIA's own prisons, but thousands more in the jails of allied countries such as Egypt and Morocco and Jordan. And that's where the Gulag term, I think, is applicable, where America comes in and how it's is in coordinating that and in actually facilitating the transfer of prisoners between these different jails.
And President Bush's comments that the United States does not engage in torture.
Well, I think as a matter of policy that the United States does not engage in torture. But the question is, which I think most people are asking, is what is the U.S. definition of torture? And there seems to be a lot of discussion on that. And it seems that what I consider to be torture is not what George Bush believes to be torture. And there's also a matter of sending someone to a country where they know for sure he's going to be tortured. Now, they've said, Condoleezza Rice has said, no one is sent to a country where they will be tortured. Well, there's no guarantee they'll be tortured, but the U.S. and the United States State Department has on repeated occasions warned that in countries like Egypt, it's very, very likely they will be tortured. And in fact, the CIA officers responsible know full well that these countries are countries that practice torture. And what I'm concerned about is that these people, these officers who've been involved in these practices, are essentially being left to hang out to dry by the administration, who are saying that, you know, no torture is involved and we've never practiced torture. Well, hang on a second. The people I've spoken to say that when this whole policy was invented, the White House and the National Security Council in Washington was fully informed by the Central Intelligence Agency that if you sent someone to a country like Egypt, it was extremely likely that they would be treated with methods of interrogation which would not be acceptable in the United States.
Or in, for example, Syria, a place that the Bush administration, to say the least, has said is a terrorist state, basically. Sent Maher Arar, the Canadian Syrian, who said he was held for a year and tortured in Syria.
Well, it's a very interesting policy for the administration, isn't it? On the one hand, seeking to advocate democracy and trying to create a wholesale change in the regime of a country like Syria, and on the other hand, basically accepting the assurances of the Syrian Baathist regime that they do not torture people.
Stephen Gray of the Sunday Times of London. And that does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Anna Nogueira, Yoruba Richin, Maddie Harper. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Again, our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Imagine no.